Hi there, and welcome to our podcast, Mindfulness at Work. I'm Cara Pollard.
Hello, and welcome to the Mindfulness at Work podcast. I'm here today with my dear friend and colleague, Tia Fagan. Tia, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and the work you do?
Sure. So I am a certified conscious parent coach, and I work with families to deepen connection and really put the relationship first in their as they parent, so that they can understand and connect with themselves, so that they can deepen that relationship. So it's really about going within and helping parents understand and meet their kids with connection. So
that's wonderful.
A short synopsis.
Yeah. Well, you do great work, and I know that you've also done a lot of work in kind of what's very appropriate at this time in this Black Lives Matter movement here with all the protests and all of our current racist society that we live in. What drew you to do some of that work?
So, longer story, I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin, which is fairly progressive, and I had been exposed to a lot of, this is a common story, so I'm just going to preface this as white fragility and privilege already, not understanding the depth of racism within our society. So I thought I was not racist because I had had so much exposure. And then as I went along my process of learning and self-growth, and I was in a online course, and a couple women reached out to me, and it was white women and people of color, and we decided to really start to dive into racism work as a nice cross-section of white women and people of color working independently and together to help deepen and go within and really start to uncover our privilege, understand what actions and words I have used that have been harmful to people. I didn't know what I didn't know, and it was hard work. So it really was the catapult for me to start to dig in and understand that what I thought I knew wasn't, and who I thought I was wasn't. And so my world really got turned upside down in a good way, because it needs to be done to understand and to become and practice being more anti-racist.
Nice. So that is a little bit different from my experience, but I mean, I know that I'm wholly unqualified to discuss racism, although I've done a little bit of work to see what implicit bias that I have and things that it doesn't matter if I was intentional or not. Your intention doesn't matter. It's how it lands, right? And so I've had to do some work and studies that I wanted to bring into my work, because if I was going to think that I could ever coach anyone of color, I felt like I needed to do a lot of work to educate myself. And I mean, I still am wholly unqualified to do that, although some people have, reached out to be coached. So I realized the work that that I thought I knew, kind of similarly to you, I had no idea. And that this is definitely, because it's been such an ingrained societal structural problem that we all engage in every day, it's going to never take one answer. It's going to never take one day. It's going to probably, because it's been so many years, continue to be something that we have to work at every single minute of every single day in our lives.
Exactly.
So this isn't, you and I aren't talking because we know what racism feels like, fortunately for us, but it's more, I think, just to maybe share the steps and missteps that we've taken along the way, so that other people can maybe see that just being silent or doing nothing or thinking you have all the answers is actually doing more harm. And even in the learning, you're doing more harm. So just that awareness in and of itself, I think, is something that if you take with you through this time, it might help. So why don't you share what this time has meant for you in particular?
That's a great question. It's really caused a lot of intense stirring within me in a way that I realized I wasn't allowing. Mm-hmm. Even though I've been doing this work for a few years now, and again, it, like you said, this is active work and it's messy, and I continue to do harm inadvertently in my words and my actions. And I think that's part of the learning process. So knowing when you embark on this journey, it's not like, oh, I start to understand and I never make a mistake again. No, we have to keep doing the work imperfectly and being okay with that. So fast forwarding to today, in the last several weeks and today, you know, I started to realize that I was doing the internal work and understanding and trying to do my best in interactions and choices and actions that I was taking on an individual basis, but I hadn't done enough work collectively and outside. Mm-hmm. An example would be, I talked about my racism work that I was doing myself only with people who I felt were safe. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, so someone would say something, and I would tend to say something like, I don't know if you realize, but that's your white privilege showing up, or that could be harmful. And then I would drop it because, mm-hmm. you know, oftentimes someone would get defensive, or I didn't feel I had the proper words to describe. And I still don't have, I'm not eloquent. I am not a teacher in this. I have so much work to continue to do. And when all of the changes and the catapults and the that has happened in the last few weeks has made me realize that I am not doing my part of being a good ally. I am not putting into action more anti-racist actions and words. And so I have been having difficult conversations with people and not dropping the conversation. But I approach it, and this is my approach with, I try to believe, I'm sure I don't do it all the time, but I try to approach it as an invitation, mm-hmm. and education, not mm-hmm. in a judgment, because I was there. I didn't know. I didn't have that awareness. So I provided the conversation, and I've had comments back and forth on Facebook on people's friends' posts, you know, so someone would post a Black Lives Matter or the opposite, an All Lives Matter or something, and I'd engage in a conversation, and I would be very mindful in my words to plant mm-hmm. seeds. So I've been taking action that way, you know, and donating and understanding, just diving in deeper to the history and the systemic places and how I can perhaps do my part of being an anti-racist, knowing that just sitting and reading and doing the internal work is super important and necessary, but I needed to do more.
Right. So I love that you're inviting people to become more educated, and you're kind of illuminating their white privilege, but you're trying to do it in a non-judgmental way, is what I hear you saying.
Exactly. Yeah. And bringing it into my work consciously. I wasn't consciously bringing it into my work in parent coaching. Mm-hmm. I think I had my privilege of like, oh, what if I lose people? You know, they don't understand if I just don't have enough of a conversation. And I came to terms, I can't do that anymore. And this is part of parent coaching for me.
Right.
Because it starts with us, and then it starts within our home, and it expands outward. And if we aren't doing the work as the parents, how can we educate and teach about racism to our children and have those conversations?
Right.
So I've actively been working with my groups about it now since that started, and I feel more aligned. It feels important and necessary for that.
Yeah, I think, it's a human rights issue, right? So it is important, and it is important and necessary. And there isn't any other human rights issue that we don't, as parent coaches or as people or as citizens, get riled up about. So why would we steer away from conversations now? I feel there's something you said that I just want to pause on. Mm-hmm. Why do people get so triggered and dig their heels in that I'm right, you're wrong, and feel so defensive when you invite them? Like, I feel like an invitation is something that should you know, put out the flames. It's only an invitation. You don't have to be so defensive when someone invites you to learn something. It's up to you. You don't have to learn it. What do you think it is about this that gets people so angry?
I mean, I can't speak for every individual, but I would say, speaking from my experience or thought, my perception through my lens, it's triggering that wound, that acknowledging that there is white privilege, acknowledging that you are a part of the problem. Mm-hmm. It's that acknowledging and having to look at those dark, shadowy bits within us, and that's hard with anything. And I think it's especially, I mean, from my experience, it's been the hardest work I have done. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing a lot of inner work for a long time with conscious parenting, but this has been hard because of the perception that when you say I am a racist or that person is a racist, that you're a bad person. It's that, as Robin DiAngelo talks about, the good, bad, it's a binary. It's not
right.
Being a racist is bad and being not racist is good. It's not that. And so once we demystify what racism is and being a racist is, or a racist act or words, that it's not that you're bad, you know, taking out the white supremacy aspect.
Right.
It just is.
It just is.
And we don't even know. And I think the other piece is, like I said about my journey, is it turned my world upside down, because like who I thought I was wasn't.
Right.
And it was a deep core part of who I thought I was. You know, I was not racist, which is a whole nother conversation, as Ibram Kendi talks about, being not racist is just neutrality, which is being racist.
Right. Right.
You know, so having to really look at everything I thought I knew in regards to race was incorrect. I shouldn't say everything, but I mean, I had the blinders on. I had had a lot of education around it. Luckily, based on how the exposure I had to the prison system and whatnot growing up. So I had dabbled and understood some of the systemic aspects, but nothing to what they didn't understand, that, you know, watching Cops in the '80s, how horrifying that was.
Yes.
And that just added more layers, the war on drug, all of those things I didn't realize. So I think when we provide that invitation, it's so uncomfortable. And when we're uncomfortable, people either have been taught to lean into that discomfort or taught to push back. And I think more people push back from that discomfort because they don't want to go there. It's too hard.
Right. It's also, though, have you found that you've had to, you know, so our society is racist. We both know that. And there are people who have done some work. There are people who are explicitly biased, and there are mm-hmm. people who are implicitly biased. Mm-hmm. Do you bother with or ever try to say anything to the explicitly biased people?
I had a conversation on Facebook, if you want to call it a conversation on Facebook. Uh-huh. So a friend of mine, a common Facebook friend, she had posted something. I honestly can't even remember what the original post was. And there was conversation, and a man who I have no idea who this person is, and this has happened several times on Facebook for me, but this one is sticking out in my brain right now. And he was very adamant, I'm not racist, very adamant that all lives matter and this is just propaganda. And he was going on, and I was still in a very neutral, non-judgmental place. And I'm like, I feel I want to create that invitation. And so I started to engage with him, and it was so fascinating for me because I would write my words and I'd look at them and be like, okay, am I causing a potential defensive reaction purposely, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. in my words. And we went back and forth, oh my goodness, probably at least 10 times. And, you know, he kept repeating the same things over and in different ways, and then would completely switch the narrative to the economy. And I would bring it back to, I'm not on here to talk about the economy. I'm here to talk about blah. And then eventually it came to a point where I'm like, and he said, you don't know me. And I said, well, and you don't know me. Mm-hmm. And you clearly don't want to get to know me. I would love to get to know you. I feel we have more in common than you realize, but I wish you well. And then he bit back again, saying something. And I just repeated myself. So I do feel it's important to have conversations with people who are more outward. And it's because, again, it's that silence. If I hadn't engaged with him, I was just engaging in more silence and privilege.
Right.
And I didn't go in there intending to that he would see the light and change his mind, because it's out of my control. But what I could control was myself and being able to be neutral and not judgmental and create the invitation, plant the seeds. And all I kept going back to is watch the documentary 13th, because it's an easy, accessible documentary that shows both sides of the political system and how both sides have played a part. So it's not specifically, you know, from one side or the other. So that's just what I kept coming back to. All I ask, and that's how I ended my conversation. You know, I wish you well, and I hope you take the time to watch 13th. And if you do, I'd love to hear back.
Right. You know?
Because if I avoided those conversations and only talked to people who I felt had done enough work or were, you know, made a comment that was I want to learn more. I'm avoiding the difficult conversations, and that is not being true to myself or to supporting creating more anti-racist policies and having people go within.
Yeah, I guess. So in my journey with racism, I found it my obligation, my whole life, to speak out when somebody said something. I didn't do it because I wanted a pat on the back. I didn't do it for performative reasons. No one knew, right? But I just conscientiously felt I had to do that. I don't think that I've changed anybody's mind, so that isn't necessarily the intent. But I do feel like if we don't practice that when it comes to being in the voting booth, when it comes to discussing policy, when it comes to having awareness about the educational inequities that are just systemic and what to do about it, I couldn't use that same voice. So I guess that was kind of like a little bit of dipping my toe in practice.
Yeah.
But I think that education is something that, and the workplace. So there's two, so that man that you were engaged with could be a decision maker at a workplace. He could be a decision maker at a school. We don't know what his job is, but it's imperative that we start to do the invitation without judgment, because you don't want to back anyone into a corner so that they don't, like the way you did it was almost just like a tap on the shoulder, which he might end up watching 13th. And maybe it would help in some way, in a deeper way. Maybe he's a police officer. I mean, we don't know what he is. Right. But maybe he could carry some of that knowledge with him into whatever he does on a daily basis. So I think that that is something that I love your example of, and words of being invitational and non-judgmental, but also not shying away, and also knowing that you've done the inner work now, you're armed with knowledge. You certainly don't know what it feels like, you know.
Absolutely not.
But you've read enough that you have a little bit more insight than you would have had you not done any of this work.
Definitely.
So tell me the resources that you have found helpful, and what, besides 13th, what other things you would share with people?
So 13th, just because it's really applicable to today's times right now, especially. And it's not picking up a book, because a lot of people are like, oh, I don't have time for a book, or, you know, that aspect. So I have a list of articles that I'll send people. I have a list of videos that I send people. And then as far as books, you know, White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo, Me and White Supremacy by Leila Saad, for me personally, was the catapult and the most impactful for me. It was the second step on my journey, intentional steps on my journey as far as active inner work, because she has prompts in there that really make you face your own, what you have done to cause harm and what your biases are and how you are showing up in the world with the everything, I mean, she has 28 prompts, 28 sections that you go through. And I always recommend people who do this workbook, well, now it's a book, book and workbook, and that you do it with someone else. And I feel I know people can do it independently, but I did it with another friend who was interested in the work. And so we met weekly and we said out loud what we wrote down. And I felt there was an incredible empowering and acknowledgement of saying it to another person, this is where I have caused harm. Mm-hmm. This is an area I need to look into. Wow, I had no idea I was doing this, or I had no idea that I was using my privilege in this way. Because when you say it out loud, it makes it, you have to own it then. You know, it's not, oh, it's just tucked away in a journal that only I've right. seen and I'm not going to talk about. And the other benefit for me personally was when she would share her, what came up for her, I was like, oh, I didn't even realize that. Yep, that's something for me. So it deepened the work to a level that it was able to really integrate within me mm-hmm. and got me more and more curious and allowed. So I actually was talking to someone the other day. I'm like, I really want to go through the workbook again, because I know uh-huh. I will find and uncover more biases and more ways that it's showing up today, because I still cause harm.
Right.
And and I'll notice it just like with parenting, you may notice like, oh, I'm not connecting right now and I'm in a punishment way, you know, I'm being triggered. Same thing with the racism work. We're right. still going to make mistakes. We are.
Right.
But when we have the awareness, then we can make the changes and try better the next time and say, I'm sorry.
Right.
Because you know you caused harm. So now I can say I'm sorry, and I know why I'm saying I'm sorry. I know why and how I caused the harm.
Right. And I think that experiential learning mm-hmm. does deepen, you know, the takeaways, right? If you read it in a book, you might say, oh, wow, you know, but I did a program similar where we would meet as a group. And when you do have to read what you wrote out loud, it makes it more real. There's accountability and, exactly. and you have to be honest. And so, you know, housing was a very interesting, you know, share for the people in the room. You know, what is your story of your childhood home? Did you own it? You know, and then we got into the history of redlining, which, you know, I was completely unaware of. So I feel super ignorant about that. And, you know, even in after the 2008, I had no idea that so many now corporations came in, swooped in, and people who foreclosed on their house, they didn't buy one, they right. didn't buy two, they right. bought 1,800 rental units or homes in a neighborhood. And so now you're renting from a corporation. Right. I mean, it just is confounding to me, confounding right. because nobody cares. The corporation doesn't care. There's nobody to mm-hmm. call when there's your lights out. And so you're not getting any equity, which is part of, you know, the wealth right. disparity. So it just, exactly. it hits on so many things, but to go and learn about it and hear people's housing story right. was so real and tangible. That was one thing to me.
Did you read the book Evicted? Have you heard of the book? I think it's called Evicted.
I have heard of it, but I did not read it. No,
it's another really eye-opening book. It was a lot of it was based out of research done in Milwaukee, but it talks about the housing inequity and single moms and the inequity against single moms or battered women and the eviction aspect with that. So that's another layer within housing that you were talking about when they come yeah. in and buy them up. Yeah.
Yeah. For a single battered woman to be the one that bears the burden of this, mm-hmm. it's just right. Inhumane. It's inhumane. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess through education begins awareness, and through right. awareness, I think, I don't know what you could do other than change. Right. And mm-hmm. so, you know, you and I both know if you're not growing, you're dying. Right. And so, you know, we've been a large part of our community and collective humanity has been dying. And, you know, we need to go through these growth changes that are going to be painful mm-hmm. in order to get to a new way. Yes. What has your experience been with the education system, and what have you learned in that realm?
Well, I mean, just how schools are funded right there uh-huh. through property taxes. And that comes uh-huh. back to the housing piece that you right. were just talking about, right? So and it shows how all these systems are interconnected, and they all influence yes. each other and build on each other in the inequity. And, you know, with the white flight, the having yes. the resources in the schools based directly on the property taxes of that district.
Right.
And it's like, so how is this there's no even playing field. There's no equity, right. none. And the fact that we're still have segregated school districts, we still have, I was reading an article this morning and written by a young Black man. And he's like, I was bused in, I think it was in the Boston area. You know, he was bused to another school still. And he's like, mm-hmm. segregation has been done for 60 years in the schools.
Right.
Yet we're still busing Black children to white schools.
Right. Nothing's so what changed. Did Brown, what did Brown versus the Board of Education do? I mean, it's the other thing that I learned, not only, you know, it is all tied together, and we know as people that this is not an accident. Right. This is not by accident. Exactly. You know, what's the definition of coincidence? Like, we believe, well, this is divine. This, God made this happen, or, mm-hmm. you know, well, somebody made this happen. It isn't an accident that they're all tied together, that property taxes funds education. And that, you know, one of the richest districts in the United States is right here in Winnetka and Wilmette. New Trier is one of the best schools in the country, and it has, you know, really great property taxes. And in the CPS system, it's interesting. There's a big disparity over some of the, greatest schools in the country, you know, selective enrollment schools and mm-hmm. where they're located. Mm-hmm. And then I went to something about, you know, equity in education. And the man said, so when you go to school on the South Side, and let's say mm-hmm. we'll take a neighborhood, I was just in North Lawndale, and you walk in the doors, first you have to go through a metal detector. Mm-hmm. Then there's police, you know, standing there, right? Then you're told to get in line, don't step out of line, and don't talk. Wow. Do not talk. And he said, all as it is, it's so preparing you for prison.
Exactly.
Prison is exactly the same way. And so I thought, what is educational about that? And why would you train someone for prison? Well, I mean, we know why, right?
Right.
And so,
right.
you know, then that then goes into the criminal justice system. And, you know, that's a huge topic. And as a coach, I mean, you know, when we talk about either defunding or reallocating the funds for the police force, mm-hmm. I think it's so important to discuss why. People yeah. think that means that we want robbers and murderers mm-hmm. to go loose. That is not what it is.
No.
But when a police officer, I mean, I can't remember what their training is, but it's so short.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there isn't much diversion training. We know that, right? Mm-hmm. Diversion and inclusion.
Clearly.
diversity. Mm-hmm. And we also know that they are asked to come to a domestic abuse situation, and they've been given no training. They're not right. trauma informed.
No.
They don't know how to ask questions. They're given very little. No counseling. I mean, they're asked to come into so many situations that it would take years and years and years of training
right.
for them to know how to address the situation, mm-hmm. let alone a suicide
right.
situation. Like, you and I know in the work we do mm-hmm. how much effort that would take. And if there's a child neglect or abuse case, right. who should be going in there? A police officer?
Exactly.
they don't know what to say to the child, to the parent. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that they're given a little bit of training, but not the degree to which they should be. So if we could reallocate that mm-hmm. and get specific people in there who could address these situations, I think that
and cause less trauma.
Yes.
You know, because there's already trauma in that situation and then potentially adding on more trauma. And how is that going within the family system and continuing more and more? I mean, it's just when you take that step back and start to understand what defunding police or reallocating funds, creating more resources to support and help people and create less trauma, it's shifting, you know, it's shifting the way we talk about it. And so people right. can understand, like you said, no one person is able to meet all of those situations that a police officer has to. And it's not reasonable to expect them to be able to.
Right.
Because right. there's multiple jobs within what you just described.
Right. Right. And if you're called because there's a suspicion of child abuse or neglect, mm-hmm. the first thing that you need to go in there is in a very calm, mm-hmm. you know, let's create some safety here. Right. You don't want to go in. I understand that it's a crime. I'm completely aware of that child abuse and neglect is a crime, but that should come way down the line mm-hmm. as opposed to barging in with a gun on your holster.
Right. And it's more of that unintentional, that not having the awareness and the understanding that ties back to how we started this conversation. Because I don't think many police officers are intending to cause more harm. I'm not a police officer. I'm not well-versed in their training I know it's not a lot of training. So, and I understand there's that aspect of someone is doing something wrong and we're afraid to speak up, especially if that person is in a position of power. I read that one of those three cops that were there, it was his third shift on the job. So knowing that, I'm not making excuses for him by any sense of the mean, but I understand how being on your third shift in a job where hierarchy is mm-hmm. very important and honored and respected because you don't cross out a line or you don't know enough as being on your third shift. So I don't know how old he is. Mm-hmm. For all we know, he's 19. Not that it's, again, not an excuse, but the system is set up that he can't say anything. Mm-hmm. And it's when the police are policing the police. And, you know, there's a lot of protection already in the law of police officers that I know how hard it was for me to say stuff early on in my journey in racism to people. Mm-hmm. Like I would have never had the conversations I've been having that I've had in the last week and a half mm-hmm. with other people that were not easy because I didn't know what kind of pushback I would have. But I had to do it. So how can we instill that in the system so that they know they can speak up and stop someone from doing what was happening?
Right.
Because clearly there's no safety to speak up. It's right. really easy to say, oh, I would have. Mm-hmm. You don't, but would you have if you were in that situation?
Right.
As a police officer, and if you're not the highest ranking. So what's wrong in the system that they're not creating the safety to have the checks and balances while you're out on a call?
Yes.
That's disturbing. Right. There's no.
I think some of the training that I've looked at for corporations, there are some mm-hmm. progressive companies that, you know, of course wanted diversity and inclusion. And it started with numbers. Well, mm. numbers is not diversity and inclusion.
Right. Absolutely not.
So then they went to some deeper training and some implicit bias training, mm. especially for managers, which is really good. But then they went even further, which is to have conversations.
See?
And yeah. And they're uncomfortable. They're uncomfortable conversations. And to allow for every voice to be heard. And why? Because, by the way, it helps your bottom line, right?
Right.
That voice and that opinion that's different from the white male patriarchy voice and opinion that does not necessarily represent our society needs to be heard. So I think you're onto something. Like, before you even, your third shift, before you go out, you should be meeting with the people you're going to be working with and be not only encouraged, but it's incumbent on you to share your opinion with them so that when you're out on the field, you could say, hey, that's, what are you doing? Have you lost your mind? You know, or so, and then of course, that also includes, you know, positions of leadership also need to be diverse and inclusive so that that voice is heard at a managerial level, so that that understanding and the fact that you need new associates, whether it's in a progressive company or the police department, to participate. And I think from that participation, we all grow and learn. And it's super imperative that we do that at this time, as you are, you know, a prime example of what the learning and the education that you've given yourself has done for you and how it's empowered you to be a voice, maybe not a voice of firsthand knowledge, but a voice that knows a little bit, to invite others to learn a little bit more.
Yeah. And I think I'd even extend that out, you know, just from my own personal looking back, you know, it's always easy to look backwards, right? Is that you can literally start saying and speaking up once your awareness has started. And lots of people's awareness has started now. So learn that you don't have to know enough. You don't have to have done this for a few years to be like, okay, now I know enough, I can say it. No, now you know, so now you can. You can speak up now. And it's those conversations. I mean, the conversations I've had that have been difficult with people who are not even, we left the conversation and nothing had changed, right? Mm-hmm. But we had a conversation and I felt, from my side, I mean, I can't speak. Maybe they were defensive and complaining about me later. I don't know, which is fine. I can't control that. But it was conversing back and forth and bringing it back to the topic and saying, we're straying off. Come back to the topic at hand. I want to hear you as a human being. I want to hear what you have to say, because then maybe you'll listen to what I have to say as well. Mm-hmm. So I think what you said, the conversations, you know, before a shift, then you have your voice during the shift and out, you know, outside of the police department, because if we can't use our voices, and not just white people's voices, of course, we need to be listening to Black voices. We need to be listening to people of color voices, because otherwise we're just looking at it through our perspective of our white privilege and all of that. So I have learned so much in the last week and a half, of doing more listening. I was listening before, but now I've elevated my listening, you know, to understand and to say, just because that person who is speaking isn't speaking in the way I would talk as an invitation, that's okay. It's still conversation. It's still learning and understanding, because I've never walked in anyone's shoes. I did not grow up as a Black woman. I grew up as a white woman. And so please help me understand. And being comfortable with that anger that may or may not be showing up. Some women I am following, there's a lot of anger and it's justified. And why am I'm not now, but I was, why, you know, because before I started this work, it was always, you know, well, if you could say that without such anger, maybe people could hear your message. I mean, that's racism and privilege and all sorts of things. And now I understand that. And so I learned and leaned into the anger, and it's like, that's okay. Cause sometimes I get angry.
Right.
And but that's part of the conversation too. So I think we have to be mindful too, that it isn't always an invitation conversation. Sometimes it can look from the outside aggressive, but it's not.
Right. And you're right. When, you know, all emotions are okay. Right.
Exactly.
And, you know, we teach in parenting, you know, in our help with parents, that your child's emotions are okay. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody's expressing themselves, just because it's uncomfortable to us doesn't mean we should shut them down.
Exactly.
We could actually learn from them. Mm-hmm. And I do think, you know, I would just like to share a couple things that I've done. I'd love to know your thoughts on it. So there's a lot of resources out there for books, you know, and that you're supposed to start talking about race very early on with kids, mm-hmm. instead of, you know, going with the colorblind, motto. You're supposed to actually be pointing out differences. And, but beyond that, in my family, my dad, is a big music guy. And so we always listened to music and, would discuss what was going on. You know, music has a historical context to it. Right. And, what the lyrics mean. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, an activity in my house when I have parties, I always throw on Where Is the Love, and everybody, you know, old people who don't know the song and young people who I don't know half the lyrics, but we all sing that song. And I think that song is so relevant. I mean, it transcends so many things, but right now it, in particular, is an old song that is just so poignant right now. But so through song, you can learn things. And then even if you're uncomfortable with right now, you want to be a little cocooned. My daughter, invited us all to do a book club. Apparently Smith College, the Woman's College, just had a spring course called Racism, in the Trump Era. Mm. And they've made the course available for free, the really? Syllabus online. And so as a family, we started and, you know, we're doing the assignments, and then we came together to discuss
nice.
What we learned. And the first week we had to, you know, write some things out and share it. And that was really helpful. But what was even more astounding was some of the videos they had us watch. And one is about fascism and how it's, you know, right here, right before us right now. And it's right. super scary. And another one was in New York City in 1939, a 20,000 person convention of Nazis here in the United States. It was unedited, and to watch this video was like, this can't be, like, you just couldn't believe it was happening. But it shows how scary, you know, it is, and how deep-seated, you know, so much hatred is. And if we don't call it out, exactly. we could be Nazi Germany. I mean, and we already right. are. I mean, we already have done so many atrocious and terrible things, but you know, to think about the short time period and the amount of people that were killed in Nazi Germany, it makes me feel like we could be there, and it would only take a couple few more horrible things to align.
Right.
And so anyway, I suggest doing something like that, especially within the safety of your own family, and then going out and expanding. So getting that knowledge, and then, you know, and you said the awareness you can start sharing right away. But it was really wonderful to share that experience with my adult children. So
definitely both of my kids took African-American studies two different classes last semester in college, and so we've had some fun conversations. I will be honest, I think some are they're both a little sick of me talking about it to some extent, especially, you know, because they both have just taken a course too.
Yes.
So, you know, it's like, yeah, I know, Mom. I'm like, okay, but I just have to keep talking. I'm doing it as much for myself.
Right.
As I am to have conversations with them.
Right.
Because they're, you know, 19, almost 20 years old. It's change, right?
Right.
We can do so much, but it's the generations that continue that need the education too. We can't isolate and not bring it into our homes. And I love that you're doing that together as a family.
Yeah. Amazing. And I love that you're doing that, because we, you know, you just showed me how you learn, but it's how all people learn. Like, you're not gonna have this ingrained in you if you just stopped at the book. You know, you need to do the workbook. You need to share it with someone else. You need to write it. And now you're saying it out loud to your kids, which is really a way of processing it and ingraining it in yourself. We actually, as a family, also went to a neighborhood and did a cleanup. Mm-hmm. And we were invited by the person who organized it to kneel for, you know, the almost 9 minutes. Mm-hmm. It was very mm-hmm. moving and very just unbelievable. But yeah. While we were doing the cleanup, I was able to talk to younger people who were cleaning up, and they were sharing with me what defunding the police meant to them. And so it's through that younger generation that I'm able to learn so much more than I would have. And so it's just, I feel honored that they share some of their knowledge with me. So, mm-hmm. I mean, these weren't my own kids.
Yeah. And I think you bring up a really good point. It's, we learn from each other. Everyone yeah. has something to teach us. We don't just have to go to experts. You know, I do feel strongly we need to be paying people of color for their knowledge and their experiences, that we shouldn't only do free things, particularly from people of color. But don't just do that. Get out and talk to different people and different experiences, and not just people who think the same as you.
Right. Definitely.
You know,
it's hard.
It's so hard, but you know, the more we can see each other as a human and talk and see their eyes, I think that's an important part of it too. We can't do this work in isolation or just in our families. It has to be done as a community.
Right.
And a country, and you know,
it's
the same with conscious parenting, right? It's, I mean, we do it in our family, but it ripples out and it expands. We don't just do the inner work and not bring it into the workplace. We do the inner work with our family, in our workplace, in our interactions at the grocery store, you know, driving down the highway. It's everywhere. This is the action piece is all of our life, not just the safe places where we feel comfortable.
Right. And I think we are called to action, and we need to step outside our comfort zones. My kids went to a private school, but you know, it's 30 years old, and for 30 years they've been touting religious and socioeconomic and racial diversity. And the headmaster said to us, if you're here, we are a mission-driven school. I encourage you to step outside your safety zones. And, you know, I really heeded her advice and went to way different neighborhoods than I am accustomed to going. And, you know, because I felt like if you're going to be in a community, and I called out people, by the way, when they made racist comments, I said, you know, and it wasn't easy. Like, why are you in this school then? Right. Why are you in this school? That is not what the school is about. So, and you know, they looked at me like, you know, I mean, some of them didn't like me, and that's absolutely okay. And, you know, my husband has taught me so much too. He isn't as much into the books or the workbooks, but he has been the head of the technology committee for a North Lawndale neighborhood community group that has like 10. So they're the head of 10 different agencies that hit upon many different areas that need help. And he is on the tech committee. So he has taught us so much about what goes on in the neighborhood, the great works that go on in that neighborhood, and then all the other stuff that needs to be done. Mm-hmm. And it's through his doing and learning and then bringing us there that, I mean, he knows way more than we do, because he goes, you know, all the time, but it's been really, inspiring to watch. And through that example, that's, you know, another way to do things. So maybe it's a class with your family, maybe it's listening to music, but it's also what you said, you know, putting those steps into actual action.
And I think what you just touched on too is a really good point. My path might not be the path your listeners take. There's no right path. They may not take the path you took. So touch in and check in with yourself. You know, what is calling you? What feels good to you? Where do you want to start to learn and get curious and explore? Because that's, then it's coming from your inner self, not trying to do it because people tell you you should.
Right.
And I think it's important you do it your way.
Right. And no, we don't want performative allyship. Right. Allyship. I mean, we want to do things because it's the right thing to do. And it's right. been the right thing to do. And we haven't done the right thing. Right. So we have to do the right thing. But you're right. Do it in the way that speaks to you. Don't do it because we told you to. Don't do it because you're performing for someone else. Do it really mm-hmm. for your inner growth. Because through that inner growth is what's going to help affect change in the wider mm-hmm. world, I think. So, right.
Right. So, there's so many resources.
Yeah.
So many resources, more than I even knew. I thought right. I knew about a lot of them. And now I'm like, oh my goodness. I mean, I found so many new people. I'm like, oh, I didn't even know she existed. I need to start learning from her and her, you know.
Yes. And thank
there's
you
so
for
much out there.
You shared a couple people with me and you know, I've already been on their Instagram and learned a little bit. I also just took a Peloton yoga class from this woman who she just graduated from Emory with a PhD. But she's somebody who, like, she brought Breonna Taylor into our intentions mm-hmm. and then would use a lot of words about breathing and aren't you lucky that you can actually breathe? And it was actually moving to even take a yoga class that had to do with race. So I think that we can do so many things that really will just ingrain some of this new knowledge into all mm-hmm. of us. And with new knowledge, knowledge is in education is, you know, powerful. It's, right. it's, really powerful. So why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about your group? Because are you inviting others to come and do more work within your group with you? Or
so the group I was referring to is I have a parenting membership group. So I'm doing okay. work in there. So it opens up a couple times a year so people can join in. I make it very accessible cost-wise, just because I want to be able to reach and access as many people as I can in the group aspect.
Nice.
So it's Shift Your Parenting, and you can find information about it on my website, tfagan.com, and just all the other stuff that I have out there and available to support families and people on their own inner growth, not just parenting. You know, I'm all about doing work with individuals too, to help them, you know, be more yeah. authentic, if you want to use that word.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, I'm a parenting coach as well, but it mm-hmm. is really about you as an individual, right? And right. parenting is a little bit of the carrot to get you, to do the work, and you do your work so eloquently, graciously, beautifully, and from such a space of spiritual wisdom that I'd like to thank you for all that, you know, we've collaborated on and that I've done in working with you. Tia, I will definitely put all of your information in the notes to this podcast, but thank you so much for sharing your journey with us here today on Mindfulness at Work, because we need to be mindful and we need to work at it, right?
That's right. Well, thank you for creating the space for this conversation. I really appreciate it and having me here. It's always good okay. to talk with you.
Well, thank you. It's a blessing to have you.
Thank you for listening to Mindfulness at Work. If you felt inspired by our conversation, we hope you'll share our podcast with your friends and colleagues.